Unconventional gas drilling damaged the environment. The techniques could contaminate groundwater if carried out improperly by causing chemical-laced drilling fluids and natural gas to leak into aquifers. Drilling companies did not typically disclose the chemical makeup of fluids used to fracture rocks for competitive reasons, so the public could not easily judge whether the fluids were dangerous to human health. The onshore gas rush also had sizable impacts on land use and development in rural areas. It turned pristine spaces into industrial zones. In the early days of the onshore gas boom, however, the drilling took place mainly in oil patch states like Texas, Oklahoma, and Louisiana, whose populations and political classes had long ago decided that the economic benefits of oil and gas exploitation, properly managed, outweighed the environmental risks. Geologists wielding modern computer software and ground penetration radar had not previously devoted themselves to looking for tight or trapped unconventional gas beds in the United States. When they did in earnest, after 2003, they reported large finds. As early as 2003, the Gas Technology Institute, successor to the Gas Research Institute, estimated that America's total natural gas resource base was about 2,000 trillion cubic feet. Americans consumed a little more than 20 trillion cubic feet of natural gas in 2003, roughly the equivalent of 8 million barrels of oil per day, or nearly the amount of the country's actual liquid oil imports. These numbers explain the very rough back-of-the-envelope forecast that the United States had a century's supply under the ground. 100 years of consumption at 20 trillion cubic feet per year equals 2,000 trillion cubic feet. As the years passed, and other government and industry panels considered the matter, they published similar top-line figures. But the estimates proved shaky. There was no doubt that there was a lot of unconventional gas in the United States, but exactly how much could be recovered as commercial fuel involved engineering questions that had barely been studied. The most bullish forecasts sounded like hype because they lacked a solid scientific basis. How long unconventional gas resources might truly last would depend, for example, on the pace of geological depletion in gas beds. This was a matter with which drillers had relatively little experience because the techniques were so new. Other factors would include the pace of demand for natural gas in electricity generation, particularly as a substitute for coal, the future of carbon pricing and greenhouse gas regulation, the trajectory of natural gas prices, and the pace of technical innovation. The idea that the United States truly had enough of its own gas to last a century seemed optimistic, but equally, the forecast in 2003 by Alan Greenspan that America might have only 2 decades of domestic supply remaining, and that we are not apt to return to earlier periods of relative abundance and low prices, had been proved incorrect. ExxonMobil re-entered American unconventional gas exploration and production on a modest scale after prices rose enough to meet the management committee's rigorous return on capital guidelines. After Tillerson took charge, he pushed into onshore unconventional gas leasing more aggressively. The environmental issues did not seem to concern him greatly. He conceded that there had been cases where the handling of fluids used to fracture rocks had not been done as well as it could be, but the incidents constituted a very, very, very small percentage in the context of total production. He also declared that the threat to underground drinking water from such drilling was very low. Tillerson's emphatic tone echoed Lee Raymond's early confidence about the evidence on climate change, but he was unabashed. Within ExxonMobil, there was controversy about shale gas, but it did not involve environmental issues. It concerned the company's strategies for replacing the amount of oil and gas it pumped and sold annually. ExxonMobil's huge investments in liquefied natural gas showed the corporation's bias toward manufacturing drilling, a phrase that referred to producing oil and gas through industrial prowess rather than wildcatter guile. "We had become a very big company that did very big projects," said a former executive. To win in unconventional gas, could ExxonMobil now adapt to the more classical land scouting, exploration, and entrepreneurial tactics required to outfox sellers and competitors? Some of the prospective challenges in unconventional gas played to ExxonMobil's strengths in manufacturing. such as the need to find engineering innovation that would improve the rates of early depletion in unconventional gas fields. But to apply its skills, ExxonMobil needed big properties at a reasonable price. ExxonMobil's profitability reflected in part the deliberate, return-on-investment-driven decision-making of its management committee. The upside was rigor and high rates of return on capital invested. The downside was caution and missed opportunity. How much of a flyer was ExxonMobil willing to take to get in on the gas rush? And how fast could the corporation move? Was it really possible for the corporation to replace reserves, capture the sudden emergence of the domestic unconventional gas play, and raise worldwide oil and gas production each year, all while demanding exceptionally high rates of return for every new project investment? In a perfect world, an oil corporation with cash flow like ExxonMobil's would pour its cash into new oil and gas reserves when commodity prices were low and milk them when prices were high, as Raymond had done with the Mobil merger. But the opportunity emerging in American unconventional gas seemed to be now, when prices were high. Should ExxonMobil compromise its profit standards at least a little to make a strategic shift? Tim Chaika, a round-cheeked Pittsburgh native who had studied exploratory geology and risen through Exxon's exploration division, ran the company's upstream operations at the time of the XTO merger talks. Chaika was an oil and gas hunter who had served as an exploration advisor to various ExxonMobil divisions before reaching the management committee. He oversaw ExxonMobil's acreage leasing in search of unconventional gas loads, 250,000 acres in the Horn River Basin in British Columbia, 400,000 acres in Hungary, and 750,000 acres in the Lower Saxony Basin in Germany.